Well, thanks for joining us once again at the London Bridge Talks. We often just remind everyone it's useful to keep these pieces of paper. Just sort of keep your eyes on those over the next few minutes. And the passage open, I'll be referring to that as we go through John chapter 9. I mean, chapter 9 is a really powerful picture showing us how Jesus is the light of the world. Just glance at verse 5. It was just before Tom started reading. We get this sort of summary. Chapter 9, verse 5, Jesus says right in the middle there, "I am the light of the world." There is the claim. And as we observed last week, light does two things. It can illuminate things you can't otherwise see, are made visible. But also, rather shockingly, light can blind. And a bright enough light can blind altogether. Last week, we met the man born blind, a horrible sort of natural state. And just by way of sort of recap to bring us up to speed, because we're going to home in on the other side of the story today, let me remind you what happened last week. We saw a few of the sort of significant details. I mean, first and significantly, the man born blind was a picture, we concluded last week, of the natural state of humanity. This is what humanity is like, spiritually speaking. It's not a very attractive one, a humbling one. But spiritually speaking, all of us in our naturally born condition, blind. And like the man born blind physically, we are spiritually unable to help ourselves. But that brings us, of course, to Jesus. And here Jesus initiates this meeting with a blind man. He opens his eyes physically, a clear miracle. We observed last week this miracle highlights Jesus' divinity. Nobody opens the eyes of a man born blind. In fact, the blind man even uses that. Now he's had his sight restored, and he gets into a debate with the religious establishment. Look at verse 32 in our reading just now. And he says, right in the middle of his sort of diatribe to the establishment, "Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind." So it's a well-attested fact that this sort of thing just doesn't happen. But again, there's much more going on than just pointing to Jesus' divinity. Big theme in John's gospel is what Jesus calls greater miracles. Jesus referring not to the physical, which obviously is impressive, but to the greater miracle, the more impressive, the spiritual. You see, what's really impressive in this passage is that this man gets converted. He worships Jesus. And so John intends us to see that the work of God is taking place, both physically and spiritually. Those two miracles are sort of woven together to show us that just in the same way, very obviously to us, it takes a miracle for somebody to have their eyes open physically, it also takes a miracle to have your eyes open spiritually. Two miracles. And Jesus says that the latter one is the greater one. Jesus, the light of the world. But he doesn't just open the eyes of the blind. He also, and this is going to be the subject for the rest of our time together, he also blinds the eyes of the seeing. And as I said last week, we're going to have to be very careful as we weave a path through this. Let me remind you, these are Jesus' words. Just look at verse 39. Jesus said, "For judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see," right? We covered that, tick that box. "And those who see may become blind." So you see the first point on the handout there. Jesus hardens those that see to make them blind. As we know, not everyone who meets Jesus or hears his words explained is attracted by what they hear. Some clearly can't really hear at all. You probably had that experience. You may be having that experience a little bit yourself if you've sort of been going along to Christian meetings and just sort of thinking, "I just don't get it." That is a normal and natural starting point. But some seem to become even harder. It's almost like they become more resistant as they hear a little bit more, to use the language of the text. It's like they're blinded further. And this seems to happen in parallel to the individual's resistance, their sort of resistance to look at the evidence that's put in front of them. So let's just sort of drill down into that a little bit and consider it. You'll see the sub-point there, the Pharisees resist the evidence. Just follow through the story. It's really interesting the way this works. Verse 13, they brought to the Pharisees the man who'd formerly been blind. I guess what they probably wanted was the establishment to sort of comment on the significance of this sort of event. I mean, they should have said, oh, wow, a man who was blind now sees. This, guys, this is the stuff we've been looking for. This is the stuff the prophets go on about. Yeah, look at verse 16. This is what actually happens. Some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath. Others said, how can a man who is a sinner do such things? And there was division among them. If there had been a sort of a ray of hope further back, well, it's quickly quashed. Look at verse 18. The Jews, that's just the word for the establishment, they did not believe that he had been blind and had received his sight. Do you see what they're doing? It's really interesting. You see, they cannot deny that this man can now see, so the obvious thing to do is to deny that he was ever blind. In other words, they know miracles can't happen. They know miracles don't happen. If someone says they have, well, there must be another explanation. There must be a workaround. And so they go through the various options. I mean, to claim that a miracle has taken place is to claim that the laws of nature have been changed or suspended. That can't happen. We know that can't happen. I mean, this was made famous, of course, in the 18th century by the well-known philosopher David Hume. I think he was the chap who really sort of first articulated this. He said, a miracle, this is a quote from David Hume, a miracle is a violation of the laws of nature. And because firm and unalterable experience has established these laws, the case against a miracle is as complete as any argument from experience can possibly be imagined to be. David Hume. The Pharisees need to make their case. And so they turn to the formerly blind man's parents to get their opinion. Slightly given up with the blind man, it seems, at this stage. Look at verse 23. His parents said, he is of age, ask him. So they're not interested in engaging in a conversation that's going to get them into deep water. And John explains why in the little comment in the verse before. So just look back at the narrator's comment in verse 22. His parents said these things because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had already agreed that if anyone should confess Jesus to be the Christ, he was to be put out of the synagogue. Which means, of course, the whole investigation was rigged from the start. The Pharisees had already decided that Jesus was an imposter. And so what they did was create a sort of a culture of fear amongst the local community. The word had gone out that if anyone should publicly confess that Jesus was the Christ, they'd be thrown out of the synagogue. That was a really bad thing. I mean, to be thrown out of the synagogue would have meant within the Jewish community in which they all lived, that would have been a social disgrace. And if you'd been employed, if you had sort of family, you'd immediately sort of be blacklisted, lose your job, unable to sort of buy simple things in the community. And I guess the Pharisees' sort of tactics are alive and kicking today. We see a lot of that sort of thing in our world today against Christianity. Because the attitude in the world around us is full of skepticism and apathy towards Jesus. There's little respect for Christianity, and there's suspicion over many of us who believe it. Well, the Pharisees' rigged investigation continues. Look at verse 24. So, for the second time, they called the man who had been blind and said to him, give glory to God. We know this man is a sinner. That's like saying, before God, own up and admit the truth. There must be other evidence that you are not telling us. And so they go over all the evidence again, assuming they'd missed something. They're determined to find, well, anything rather than admit the truth. It reminded me as I was going through this and preparing this, I used to, when I had a job before I became a church minister, I used to work in an office in the West End helping businesses grow. And I had a colleague there called Phil, really nice chap. Over a number of years, we got to know each other quite well. Had a lot of good laughs with Phil. Over the time, I shared my Christian faith and often got into good debates with him. lots of conversations about the gospel. He heard it many times. He was always happy to debate with me. He quite liked it. But his aim was to try to catch me out. He wasn't hungry. He was trying to find difficulties and flaws. I don't know if you've had those sort of conversations. And he always assumed, his starting point was a position of assumption that assumed that he could explain everything. And he was determined to do so. And so, you know, he often had very good arguments. And sometimes I didn't, you know, wasn't immediately able to reply. But sometimes I did have very clear arguments that he couldn't reply to. And his sort of final sort of reposit at that point, I'm just not convinced. I just don't believe. As has been famously said, convince a man against his will, and he remains unconvinced still. And we can see the Pharisees belligerent to the end. Look on to verse 34. You were born in utter sin, and you would teach us? And they cast him out. You see, in the end, the only option left to them, rather than believe, was to get rid of the evidence, put it out of their sight altogether. The formerly blind man is thrown out. Now, their refusal to believe leads to a sort of disgust with the evidence, a disregard for the evidence, a desire to remove the evidence. That day, it was the blind man, or at least the man formerly blind, I need to say. Within a short amount of time, it would be Jesus, of course, as Jesus would be nailed to a cross. And of course, as was the case with the man who was given sight, so is the case with the men ignoring the evidence. There's more going on than first meets the eyes. So the presenting issue, the Pharisees refused to accept the evidence, harder and harder to the evidence. Disregard to the evidence. So that leads us to the next sub-point there. The Pharisees experience a judicial hardening. You see, there is something worse than being blind in our world today. And that is being blind, but thinking you can see. That, friends, is a really dangerous position to be in. Let me just repeat that. It's so important. There's something worse than being blind, and that is being blind, but thinking you can see. And that's the position that the Pharisees are in. They are people who declare boldly, it isn't true, it can't be true, we know it's not true, we'll prove to you it's not true. We can see there all there is to see, there's nothing else left to see. And Jesus says, verse 39, for judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, but those who see may become blind. Now, Jesus doesn't go around blinding the eyes of seeing people. We need to be clear about that. There are no recorded incidents of people with perfect physical sight meeting Jesus and having their sight taken away. That's not what Jesus is talking about. When Jesus says in verse 39, just look at the second half of there, that those who see may become blind, what he's describing is part of his work behind the scenes of a further spiritual blinding. You see, the first part of verse 39 helps us a little bit. For judgment I came into this world. In other words, whilst it is true that Jesus came into the world to save people, one of the inevitable consequences of people being saved, that means converted, is that there will be other people who are not saved or judged. And what's fascinating is the very process of giving the blind man sight leads to a number of the Pharisees actually becoming confirmed in their unbelief, the judicial hardening taking place. This is an act of judgment against the Pharisees, and the end result is they become blind. To make sense of that, we just need to really see that when Jesus says, those who see, we must read it as those who think they can see. We're talking about the sort of the attitude, the characteristic that assumes it knows best. It has no need for further illumination. It was Phil, through and through, the guy I used to work with, absolutely determined that he knew all there was to know, and that if I had anything to say that didn't fit his worldview, I was the one that was wrong. When such a person meets Jesus, they'll do anything to resist and object to what Jesus has to say. And so what that means is that the light that Jesus is blinds them further. In other words, Jesus is sort of confirming them in their unbelief. This is the judicial hardening that takes place. We need to be clear. I mean, this guy in the story, my colleague Phil, anybody in this natural state of not seeing Jesus, it's not that they start off innocent. It's not that they start off even neutral. Look at the phrasing again in verse 41. If you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now you say we see, your guilt remains. To say that their guilt remains shows us that they started off guilty and now they continue guilty. There's no neutrality. Jesus says that they may become blind. I mean, this happens in a number of places in the Bible. This is not a sort of a unique idea to John 9. You think of a number of other places where we see similar examples or Jesus using sort of parallel language. Let me just give you one other example, which I think helps, you know, another sort of spotlight cast on the same thing helps a little bit. In Matthew's gospel, Jesus explains the purpose of parables. And he says, to the one who has, more will be given, and he will have an abundance. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. You can see this idea of sort of further blinding, further judicial intervention. It's the danger of thinking you can see when actually you can't. And the passage warns such people, those who think they can see, they'll actually be blinded further hardened, further confirmed in the unbelief. Like my friend Phil, always trying to catch me out. Once he even said, you tell me something about your faith, you tell me something, and then I'll tell you what's wrong with it. That's the sort of challenge he left me. It can happen more subtly as well. My wife and I have noticed this. We've been married over 25 years now, and we've just noticed through that time as we've dealt with members of our wider family, some that we've had regular opportunities with, and we've just seen, whilst there was sort of relative reception at the beginning, willingness to talk, come along to sort of church services we invite them to, there's increased hardening now. We've seen real decline. That's what Jesus is describing here. Doesn't mean everybody moves in the right direction. The reformers captured this very well, and they spoke about this this phenomenon of sin. So a natural situation of being opposed to God and sort of reveling in that leads to a further indulgence in sin. They would say sin is sometimes given as a punishment to sin. It's this downward spiral. And it's a self-inflicted downward spiral. It's a very dangerous position to be in. That's what's going on here. So by way of very brief conclusion as we come to an end, in the end, people in this position only have themselves to blame. I hope that's really obvious. Refuse to accept the evidence. What do you think is going to happen? But this text is primarily written to us who believe or who are looking into belief. It's the audience. Why? Well, to help us in our expectations about what happens as the gospel goes out. Some people see. But other people are going to be put on a bit of a trajectory, sometimes, of further blindness. The Lord will open the eyes of unbelievers. We should expect that. But that's not all we should expect. We should expect opposition around us. So what about you? I mean, if you're somebody, and we often at lunchtime talks, we have people who are at sort of various stages of investigation, not yet believing, perhaps that's you, then I want to be really clear. The fact that you're being here today not believing, it doesn't mean you're going to be hardened in that. It means take the evidence that's presented. Look at where the evidence leads. Don't be like my friend Phil, like the Pharisees. It can't be true. Say, well, maybe this is true. I'll hear a little bit more. That would put you on the same course as the man who was blind and now sees. And that's a good course to be on. Why don't I close there? I'll pray briefly and hand back to Tom. Father, do help us to really think carefully about what this means personally. And we just commit this wonderful story and our own thinking about it to you. In Jesus' name, amen.